Good afternoon, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's webcast series, U.S. Global Health Policy in Focus. We're coming to you live from our broadcast studio in Washington, D.C. I'm Jen Cates, Vice President at the Kaiser Family Foundation. In Focus brings you discussions and takes your questions about current issues and debates concerning the U.S. government's role in global health. Each live webcast features leaders in their field sharing their views and experiences. Today, we are pleased to have an expert panel to discuss the President's fiscal year 2013 budget request and what it means for U.S. global health efforts. In his request, the President included $8.5 billion for programs under the Global Health Initiative, a $300 million decrease from fiscal year 2012. Almost all programmatic areas experienced decreases, though there were notable exceptions, including U.S. multilateral contributions to the Global Fund and Gavi. So what do these numbers mean for U.S. global health efforts? Where were the decreases, and what are the potential implications? What does the global health budget, how does it fit into the broader foreign assistance budget, and how might Congress react? Here to talk about these issues are three experts. We have Ambassador Mark Dybul, Distinguished Scholar and Co-Director of the Global Health Law Program at the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University, and Inaugural Global Health Fellow at the George W. Bush Institute. Larry Knowles, who's an expert consultant on the foreign aid budget and has worked for many different organizations. And Beth Tritter, the Managing Director of the Glover Park Group. Welcome to all of you, and thank you very much for being here. And to our audience, today's conversation is a live webcast, and we encourage you to submit questions to us along the way by emailing or via Twitter using the hashtag KFFInFocus. I'll be monitoring questions as we go. So I'd like to start by acknowledging that the fiscal year 13 budget request was released during a very particularly austere and dynamic time with the post-economic crisis, the election year, and I want to read actually from the budget message itself that the President wrote. He said, "Meeting the spending targets in this budget meant some very difficult choices, reforming, consolidating, or freezing programs where we could. Every department will feel the impact of these reductions as they get cut, as they cut programs or tighten their belts to free up more resources for areas critical to economic growth." And Secretary Clinton, in her statement about the international affairs request, said, "We know that this is a time of fiscal constraint and economic hardship for the American people, so we were seeking out every opportunity to work smarter and more efficiently. We have proposed painful but responsible cuts without compromising our national security mission. We are capitalizing on efficiencies in our global health programs, reducing our fiscal year 2013 requests by approximately $300 million. So this is the broader context in which the specifics of the global health request should be considered. So I think it's important to start in that broader context and think about how global health fits into the international affairs budget request, because that's really where the bulk of the funding is. So Larry, we're going to turn it over to you, since this is really the area that you can shed some light on. What happened with the international affairs budget request? What increased, what changed, what decreased, and what signals were sent this year generally?
Okay. Thanks, Jen. Great to be here this afternoon. The international affairs budget request is $56.2 billion. That includes both base funding and the overseas contingency operations account for the frontline states, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. It's a 2.4% increase from 2012. But it's a very different budget than we've seen over the last decade, more than a decade, since 9/11, when international affairs budget requests have been increasing in double digits. Just last year, the President requested over $61 billion for international affairs, $5 billion more than in this budget request here. So 2.4% is a relatively very modest increase in historical terms. But at the same time, I think it suggests a very strong commitment from the White House to the civilian side of our national security. If you look at other portions of the budget request for discretionary spending, the Defense Department is cut 1%, Homeland Security cut 0.5%, HHS discretionary funding down 8%. So relative to the overall budget, this is somewhat protected in that way. It's going to get even more difficult, though, for international affairs when it gets to the appropriations stage, because they're not looking at the overall budget, this $56.2 billion. They're only looking at the base appropriations for their spend, what's available under the spending caps. And there they're going to be looking at a 9.8% increase for state foreign ops and other international programs. That will be a daunting task. So what's new in this budget? The two areas that grow are new initiatives, the Middle East, North Africa Incentive Fund, not a surprise, a to position the administration for reacting to Arab Spring. That's a $770 million account. And then there's debt relief for Sudan proposed, brand new. It's very tentative. Whether the country will qualify for this is very uncertain, but that's a $250 million request. Unlike over the last decade when three-quarters or more of the accounts rise, this one has very, very few accounts that grow to any extent. Besides the two initiatives, we do have increases in narcotics and law enforcement, but that's largely due to a big increase for Afghanistan. There's a greater ability of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation to back loans and loan guarantees abroad. But for most account, it's flat spending or declines, development assistance, USAID operating expenses, MCC, Peace Corps, multilateral development banks, all flat funding. Decreases, global health, which I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about here, along with humanitarian assistance, is cut even larger, to a larger extent than global health. And we had aid to countries in Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, cut 18%. So very different requests from the 9/11, and there's no prospect of little prospect of supplementals in this budget environment, which was always the release valve in the past. So it's a very challenging year for international affairs overall.
Let me pick up on a few things that you said that are sort of buzzwords or words that maybe people watching might not understand. You talked about spending cuts, the caps. I mean, and we some of us have heard about sequestration and that process getting started and what it all means. Can you tell us a little bit about the spending cuts? I'm also hearing the president's budget is proposing to eliminate the separate spending caps between defense and non-defense discretionary funding. What will that do? Is that really what the budget does? And just give us a little bit more context
there. Well, there's a lot of uncertainty, first of all. So everything I'm going to say here is likely to change.
Okay.
Under the Budget Control Act passed last August, Congress and the administration agreed to a series of discretionary spending caps out to 2021. For the first 2 years, 2012, 2013, there is a division between security and non-security programs. International fell into the security cap with defense, homeland security, and veterans affairs. However, the Budget Control Act also stipulated that if the supercommittee had not had its recommendations enacted by January 15th of this year, which a month ago, the caps would change, and it would be now defense and non-defense, and international affairs would move to the non-defense category, and this made a bigger challenge for defense spending by doing that, and that these caps would continue out to 2021. And then it also provided that if $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction was not achieved by January 15th of 2012, that there would be a sequestration or a cancellation of funding that would start on January 2nd, 2013, that according to CBO would cut an additional 7.8% of discretionary spending. So that is looming out there. The president's request, however, assumes that there will be a deal reached on $1.2 trillion. The president has put forward a package that would achieve and exceed that. And so they're going on the assumption that really nothing has changed. We're going to get a deal. We're going to continue business as usual. International affairs will be in the security cap for 2013, and then the caps merge, and there's a single cap from then on. And there will be no sequestration in come next January. That's all part of a deal going forward, and I'm sure there will be a vigorous debate, in fact, but little will really be done until we get to November after the elections.
Actually, I want to turn to Beth because that's where Congress comes in, and curious on what you think Congress's reaction to the budget will be and their appetite for this. These issues, I mean, it's a very partisan environment. What are we going to hear? And then there's what we hear and what might actually happen. We saw a little bit of that last year where there was some real concern that the global health budget would be cut, and then in the end, actually, it fared relatively well. So what's your What is happening on the Hill?
I mean, I think, first of all, what's happening on the Hill is they're not actually a whole heck of a lot of people who are focused on the 150 account budget, and probably even fewer who are focused on the global health budget within that. So it's really, you know, as usual, sort of up to folks on the outside to, you know, raise awareness about, you know, what is needed out of this budget. So I don't think folks are really obsessing over exactly what 150 is going to get at this point. I think the budget committee on the House side is starting their work. I don't think we'll see any budget resolution come out of the Senate, but I'm sure we'll see something come out of the House. So the process will probably end there because it's very highly partisan. But the budget committee is going to want to come back with sort of a counterpoint to what the president came out with, and we can fully expect that they'll do that. And then the action will really move to the Appropriations Committee. The appropriators can choose a number of different pathways toward trying to sort of solve this budget puzzle this year. They can appropriate as if sequestration is going to happen, or they can appropriate as if just the caps are going to be in place. What would be better, certainly, is if they don't appropriate as if sequestration will happen, because if they're trying to presuppose that sequestration will have happened for fiscal year 13, you'll see numbers that are a lot lower than you will if they're just appropriating into the current Budget Control Act caps. What we hear is that, at least on the House side, the State Foreign Operations Bill, which includes most of this global health funding, is going to go up earlier rather than later. Mm-hmm. Usually you see it sort of go in the last tranche of bills when there's a little bit of, you know, appropriations fatigue maybe, and there might not be as much controversy, but it could get front-loaded this year, so we could see it happen a little bit earlier, and that could actually raise more awareness of the budget than maybe some folks would want, and because with awareness comes controversy and amendments and things like that. But I think that, you know, I think that appropriators are reasonable people who have really sort of black and white stark decisions to make. Mm-hmm. They have a finite amount of resources and they have to fit a whole bunch of things into it. So I'm actually interested to see how the debate is going to unfold on Capitol Hill over these proposed cuts to global health, and whether you'll still see people try to come in and backfill those or really whether, and we could talk a little bit more about that later, but or whether they're going to take this as an austere time and you know, we have to make tough decisions. Right.
And let's move to global health specifically. I'm going to bring Mark in a minute. In the budget, as I mentioned earlier, there was a $300 million approximately decrease over fiscal year 12 levels for global health, and almost all areas had cuts. Some might even see these as trade-offs between different parts of the portfolio. So there were decreases proposed for maternal and child health, about 5%, for nutrition, 5%, malaria, 4%, TB, 7%. The biggest one for neglected tropical diseases, 25%. And the largest percent decrease and the largest amount of the decrease was in HIV bilateral, so by more than $500 million. So that's like a 10% decline. Funding for family planning was relatively stable, went up a little bit, and perhaps the most notable increases were the Global Fund and Gavi. And there were also some interesting things with prior year adjustments around support for the Global Fund and Gavi. So, Mark, if you can just give us a little bit more information on the president's request related to the Global Fund and Gavi and what it signaled. I mean, what happened and what it signaled. There are big increases proposed, and send some kind of message.
Well, the increases really are to meet pledges that the administration made to those institutions to reach the $4 billion pledge that was made to the Global Fund. And even this won't quite get, it would actually get us there. And a pledge made by the administration to Gavi earlier this year. So it really is to meet those pledges, which is a very important thing for the United States to do. I mean, the one thing the United States has always tried to enforce is we will not make, it doesn't matter what the administration, Democrat or Republican, we won't make pledges unless we intend to meet them, which runs counter to a lot of our global colleagues who don't quite have that rigidity. And so I think it's a very good thing. But an administration has to work with Congress. Unlike many other places, we also don't just get to have the administration determine what those levels will be, which is a unique part of our governing structure as well. To me, it's a healthy conversation and a natural evolution in a sense. I mean, I hope we've moved past, and I think we have, the bad old days of bilateral versus multilateral, and more of a conversation of what's the right synergistic approach and where is the U.S. today and what's the right approach for the future and what's a transition period. I think in general, you would find many people who would think that a multilateral approach has advantages both because we're part of a world approach that provides resources you know, that allows countries to support national strategies, but also because it cushioned us. I mean, if we're holding the bulk of resources for, say, antiretroviral treatment or replenishing malaria bed nets, that's different than if it's something that the world is sharing globally. So there are many advantages to operating in this way. And the question is, what's the transition pace? At what point do you move, and what do you need to see in order to move in that way? And I think we've seen some real efforts on the part of the multilaterals, particularly Gavi and the Global Fund, revitalize themselves to begin to move in a direction of providing the accountability and the requirements that the Congress and the administration needs to say it's okay to have our resources in a multilateral and bilateral way and what that division should be. So I think it's a healthy conversation to have. I think it matches the administration's dedication to their pledges and meeting their pledges, which is something, again, I think all American administrations have had. And it's also part of the conversation of what is the right pace for the transition, mm-hmm. and is that a right approach? And I think, again, the key point to Congress, and I think to the administration too, is that make sure those revitalization efforts, those efforts to ensure accountability, transparency, results, that all of those are moving in a way that gives comfort levels to moving towards what I think many would agree is the right approach overall.
What about, and you alluded to the Global Fund changes and reforms, and I think that's what you meant about the Global Fund really taking a hard look and making some changes that made the U.S. a little bit more comfortable potentially in moving forward with meeting the pledges. But doesn't a lot of the administration's request, isn't it predicated on other donors stepping up to the plate for the Global Fund too? And how does that play into this?
Yes and no. I mean, there is still a requirement in the law on the Global Fund. We don't have one on Gavi, but we're nowhere near there because other countries, the U.K. and right. Norway and the Gates Foundation are the larger contributors there. That we can never provide more than 33% mm-hmm. of the overall budget. Now, I actually haven't done the calculation, maybe one of you two have, on whether or not the 1.6 would put us above that 33%. Mm-hmm. Probably get us pretty close because we're under. Mm-hmm. So we can never go higher than that 33% anyway. But one of the issues around a higher U.S. contribution is pushing higher and higher the overall response from the world to that. And the U.S. can stand alone. And that's one of, you know, that's a fundamental point I mentioned on the Global Fund and Gavi, is that we're not the only ones in there. And right. so we don't have these longer term commitments when we're all contributing together and when it's a joint shared responsibility. And that, to me, philosophically and theoretically, is the right way to go. It's good for taxpayers because we're not the right. only ones out Look. There. It's good for long-term approaches that support countries, the countries themselves, to develop national programs that are responsive, where they have to contribute their own resources as well. So I think it's theoretically and philosophically the right approach. It's always in the detail. Are the institutions in a place where the American people, the Congress, the administrations have confidence? Right. And these revitalization efforts that were begun with Michelle Kazakhstin and are now moving forward with managing director at the Global Fund, and there'll be a new executive director. Gavi did restructuring. Mm-hmm. So there's really a move to be responsive. And I actually think we should all be very pride as a vice, but we should all acknowledge that it's been the United States that have driven this mm-hmm. results-based accountability approach in multilaterals. And to the extent we can drive that, that's a great position to be in.
Right. So now I'm going to ask the harder question, because some of the reaction to the budget request on the part of others has been great on the Global Fund, but what's happening with HIV bilateral? And maybe it goes back to your statement about the pace. Is it the right transition pace? So with a cut of about $500 million on the bilateral side, obviously the two work closely together, mm-hmm. but should we look at that? How should we understand that at this point in time?
Well, a couple of things on that. One, first of all, I'm fundamentally an activist and believe I want more money for everything. But I also understand that we're in very austere mm-hmm. times and that choices have to be made. And I think the calculation has to be that transition period. Are we moving in a direction that we have accountable multilateral institutions that, in effect, cushion the American taxpayer and Congress from long-term commitments that we are shouldering ourselves, and is that pace right? And I think the administration has made a calculation that these revitalization efforts have moved. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a conversation with Congress and others. Of course, I'd like to see more money for everything, but, you know, Ambassador Goosby, I have total trust and confidence in Ambassador Goosby and in his team, in Secretary Clinton and her team, Raj Shah and her team, the White House team. I mean, they care deeply about these issues and think about them. And if, to the extent that they believe we are on that right path and they are comfortable with that path, I, even as an activist, will defer to them, because I also know that they know 90 times more than any of us on the outside, no matter what. They have a much better sense of things, and so I think we need to give them some latitude. If they say, as Eric has, that he has the resources to meet his requirements and needs and reach his budgets, and that this is a good trajectory for us to be on, and the transition can be made, and we're going to work carefully and closely and constantly reevaluate, which they always say they will do, right the right trajectory is, working very closely with Congress, that is a good, solid, reasonable approach, one that makes a lot of us uncomfortable appropriately. But I think we have to give a lot of latitude here, especially in these tough budgetary times, to let the people in the middle of it all the time, with input, there's always a role for input and advocacy, but to let them have some time to work this out and reevaluate with the advocacy community, with Congress, if that's the right trajectory. But I think as a starting point, it's a pretty good marker to lay down, and a vision. It has vision to it. It's not just a budget-cutting right. thing. There's vision to it, and there's a philosophical foundation for it.
So let's go to Congress again, Beth. I'm going to keep looking at you for that question. But obviously you said it would be interesting to see how Congress reacts to this.
Yeah.
But any thoughts on that, the HIV bilateral reduction specifically? But there were some others. NCD's got a pretty big cut in the proposed budget. We got a question on that from a listener. And we also got another question from another listener around the family planning reproductive health line and how that went up a little bit. Is that a sign of real support, or is it a risky area still for funding? So just put you on the spot a little bit.
Well, it's difficult to sort of figure out what this budget says. Everyone likes to say, you know, a budget is a policy document
right.
more than anything else, and sort of budgets tell stories about
right.
what priorities are, and, you know, they're about tough decisions. It's been very difficult for me, even listening to some of the messaging that's coming out of the administration
right.
already on the budget for the budget request for fiscal year 13, what the story is. I don't quite understand what, you know, you keep referring to a transition pace and a trajectory. Are we talking about a trajectory with respect to our global health programs, or is this a one-year thing where, you know, we found ourselves with less money than we wanted mm-hmm. and we had to make some tough decisions? You know, is there a programmatic impact, or is everything, you know, sunshine and roses and we're going to be able to still hit all of our targets even with fewer resources? I'm not saying it's really a binary
right.
issue, but I am saying that I think that there hasn't been enough clarity yet on what the vision is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this administration put out the Global Health Initiative. I don't really think that there's been a whole lot of buy-in on the part of Congress in the GHI.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was huge buy-in on the part of Congress in PEPFAR, and to a certain extent, you know, the fund and sort of the partnership between PEPFAR bilateral and the fund. I think that transitioning to a GHI mindset has been very different and very difficult. And I don't necessarily think that maybe there is a narrative, but Congress and the administration are in different points in the narrative, and
yeah.
Congress hasn't quite caught up to the administration. I think it's the administration's responsibility to catch Congress up
mm-hmm.
if they actually want to move in a different trajectory. So the truth is, I can't tell you what all of these cuts mean.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you necessarily what the rationale is behind them, or what the vision is for the future, for GHI and what we're trying to achieve with that. For, you know, is GHI really a rebalancing? If you look at the impact of the cuts on bilateral HIV/AIDS, I would say, yes, GHI is a rebalancing of the way we're spending.
Mm-hmm.
But it hasn't come with, except for the fund and the Global Fund and Gavi, really, it hasn't come with major increases for anything else. So it's not really a rebalancing. It's just sort of is it diminishing? I don't know. I guess that's the point. And I think that Congress really doesn't know either. my sense is that there aren't that many people who are hyper-focused on this right now. But, you know, Congress knows what it knows, which is that, you know, 50% of the people who are still on Capitol Hill voted for, you know, major authorizations for PEPFAR. Global health has always enjoyed a lot of bipartisan mm-hmm. support. I think it will continue to enjoy a lot of bipartisan mm-hmm. support. Global health was not the controversy that, you know, that kept Congress and the administration, you know, at loggerheads last year. It just wasn't. And I think we saw with the outcome being relatively good for global mm-hmm. health and global development that, you know, that really wasn't where the controversy mm-hmm. is. I don't think that's where the controversy is this year either. But I think there has to be a better understanding between the administration and Congress about where these budget figures take us and what the story is, what the next step is.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Because I saw you.
No, I actually think that's right. I think that's right. And, there, you know, the people who every day, which are in the administration, are thinking about this and doing this, people in Congress have a whole bunch of other things that they're working on. And the appropriators have a huge, especially in the House, have a very large portfolio, and in the Senate, even, you know. So they can't concentrate on this every day, whereas the administration does. And I think Beth's point on the need to explain your thought process and your vision is really important. And that's, I think, what developed the partnership on global health with Congress, that there's a constant back and forth and an explanation. Even where Congress disagreed with the vision, they said, well, you guys are thinking about this a lot. I'm not sure about that, but we'll give you a little latitude to work it out. And then just tell us how you're going. And that's the process that works. It doesn't work if you just, you know, have budgets up. But the administration, I don't think, has been approaching it that way. And I know Eric and Raj and Lois Quam and others are up there a lot and are up there a lot recently trying to walk through this. I think the bigger point of what is there a trajectory and is there a vision for this is a real one. And I think I have a sense of that, but others might not. And I think it's really important to bring that out. It's also important. And this is the danger of any cut, is it's really hard to reverse a cut.
Right.
I mean, once you start moving downwards, it's really hard to say, oh, now we need to go back up. And so the part of that explanation, which I think Eric is doing a fantastic job on, but I'm a little biased, is saying, look, the last thing we need is have a lot of money that's not being used. In any budget, that's a bad thing. In this budget, that's catastrophic. You can't just have unused money. So right now, this is the money we can use. This is the money we think the Global Fund can use, given where they are. And this is what we're trying to get to. And so, well, we're giving this budget this year, but that doesn't mean we want to keep coming down, or that doesn't mean this trajectory needs to stay. We need to keep reevaluating. We want to do it with you. And the reason that's so important is we can take a minute, because we're going to be talking about a lot of difficult things. The moment we're in global health right now is an extraordinary moment, one that we haven't seen in a long time, where scientific advance has given us the ability to really put together packages of resources that will allow us to really begin to end the AIDS epidemic. I mean, we really do now have prevention tools added on to existing tools that we can ride a downward trajectory. People say prevention hasn't worked. It has worked. We don't know why it's worked, but we know that it has. We have huge reductions across sub-Saharan Africa. But in mature epidemics, like in the United States, we're seeing a bump up. So we can either ride that downward wave with existing interventions, or we can sit around and wait until it comes back up. And that's a real danger, to sit around and say, well, we're in tough budget situations. Let's cut things now. In 5 years, we'll come back. And we can do that. May not be the case. And 5 years could cost a lot more money. We may not actually be able to achieve the same results. Mm-hmm. Same in malaria. I mean, malaria made huge progress. Report just came out, 20% reduction in mortality. There's the possibility of a bed net that will last 6 years rather than 2 years, which would save $1 billion by going that aggressively towards that. As importantly, if we don't replace the nets that are already out there, we're actually going to have malaria epidemics that are worse than the epidemics we currently have, for medical reasons I don't think we need to get into. Same in child health. I mean, we can actually end preventable childhood death within probably 20, 30 years. Vaccination, malaria, vaccination that deals with pneumonia and respiratory diseases and diarrhea. You do those things and you're actually on a trajectory to end childhood death. Things we couldn't have done before. Maternal health, we could have actually gotten rid of most preventable maternal deaths 10 years ago. But if we intensively invest now, but the opportunity is one we've never had before. And these windows don't stay open long. And so, yes, it's tough budget times, and yes, we need to work on trajectories and what's the right amount here and this year. But I think the conversation should be what's the right amount this year and not presume that that same downward trajectory or upward trajectory is the same next year. And we should always look at how much money do we have, how much money do we need, how do we achieve these goals, not only in the United States, but globally. How do we have countries contribute more, which increasingly they are, and that's an objective of the administration as well. How can a South Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, Zambia, as countries are moving up the economic ladder into middle income, how can they contribute in a new way? We do have opportunities to achieve results that we have never had in our sights before. So as we're looking at the difficulties of the budget, I think we should also look at the opportunities that are out there and make sure that we are spending money rightly and the most effective way to achieve those outcomes. And that leads to the conversation and the vision, and that's a constant back and forth with Congress.
No, I would completely agree with that. I think that, this has actually provided a really interesting opportunity and an interesting opening, and if it's taken advantage of, it could be really quite positive at sort of changing all of our outlooks. I think we got very used in the last 10 years, because there was so much money out there, to thinking in terms of, what really matters about PEPFAR or this or that is that it's a $50 billion program or a $10 billion program, or that our pledges, it shouldn't be really about that. It should be more about what we're trying to achieve. And I think that this administration, a year and a half ago, and I didn't hear any of it mentioned last week, but a year and a half ago, they put out this presidential policy directive on global development. And in it talked a lot about, working more with developing countries and trying to figure out what their priorities were and working with multilaterals and trying to get that balance right. A lot of what I heard from the administration last week seemed to come, it was a page really taken out of this policy that was put out 18 months ago and sort of a lot of people have forgotten about or really haven't engaged with. It seems that the administration is using its budget really as an expression of this policy, but it would be interesting to see them take that a little bit farther and really try to explain a vision for the future on the funding aspect of things, comparing it to where their policy is going.
Yeah. And one thing on this. You asked me in your opening question about what message does this budget send, and I totally ducked it.
You can come back and
together.
Offer now.
But
I didn't know.
Beth just stole my point. Sorry. Here is that, look, there were two clear, there's a lot of messages in the Presidential Policy Directive on Global Development, but two that have relevance to this budget is looking at greater efficiencies, more evidence-based approaches and priority scaling up those things. At the same time, they talked about selectivity. Making those tough choices and doing things differently or downscale. So I don't think the statement on global health is about selectivity, but you do have to think about that. What I do think is that this is possibly an opportunity of doing more with less. It's a very good story about how we've made improvements to the point where we don't need the resources, yet we can keep our commitments, we can keep our pledges, reach our goals. That needs to be explained very, very clearly. And I think that is what the White House needs to do in order to have a more constructive dialogue with the advocacy community.
And to be clear, that doesn't set in stone that this is the trajectories for years, that this is what we can do this year, and we're going to be looking with you each year on what we can do to achieve those effectiveness, to work with countries to see what they can bring forward, to work with the multilaterals, and we'll package that each year along this vision. So I think it's really important.
And I think it's a good, if we're able to do this in global health, there are other areas on global initiatives, on food security, for example, of how we move forward there, leveraging other donors or finding new techniques, new avenues in our own programs on agriculture and things. That could be replicated there using the multilateral development banks for economic growth strategies. I mean, there's a whole lot of range of things that we can learn mm-hmm. from this.
So we've gotten several questions that are talking about the targets, not just the HIV targets, but all the targets. And how are we going to, how can we meet the targets that were set with less money? I mean, how is that possible? And specifically on the HIV side, World AIDS Day, President Obama announced a very ambitious goal of treating 6 million people on existing resources at that time, and now we're here a few weeks later with less. How can that goal be met, but also all the other goals? That we're, given that there's all this opportunity, how can we, maybe it's the vision that we're all looking for that you mentioned, but where's the vision that connects the current year pot to those goals? I don't know if anyone has thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about a couple of them because I know them well, and I'm sure you all do too. On the HIV one, you know, the cost to the U.S. government to treat someone is dramatically decreased from the first day of PEPFAR to today. Some of that is you have upfront capacity that you need to build, and that's very expensive. But once that's been built and you're enrolling the same people in those clinics, the cost per person goes down dramatically. The cost of delivering antiretroviral therapy has dropped dramatically because of the supply chain management system, which was an intentional approach that was created so that you could do bulk procurement, which has dropped prices dramatically. We're down to $70 a year from when PEPFAR was announced, $1,500 a year, $70 for the 3-in-1 combination that is widely used, although there's some change in that that will bump up the price to use more effective regimens. But still, that's a lot of that has to do with pooled procurement. There's the ability to actually build systems, national systems, that can forecast. So instead of having everything dropped in by air, which is what was happening early in HIV, because no one could forecast how many drugs they need, it's now all going by ship because there's good forecasting. That drops the cost by 75%. And then you have, as we moved, as we did in the United States, from most care being in hospitals, because you need to, that's where you start building the capacity. As you move out to rural settings, where instead of doctors there every day, you're down to nurses who can do 90% of this, community healthcare workers, your costs drop significantly, as they do as you move out in anything. So, and then other countries and multilaterals have been stepping up. So then the cost to the U.S. government goes down. So we can't look at it as cost just for us, but it's what's the global cost and how do we work, put these pieces together? And so the cost per person has dropped from around $1,000 towards the end of the Bush administration, around $300 per person to the U.S. government because of these efficiencies, which gets back to the efficiency point. Same on some issues related to malaria. The prices are coming down. If we can shift to a 6-year bed net instead of a 2-year bed net, that saves $1 billion. That's a investment, upfront investment that saves a lot of money. So you and we need to get more efficient about how we are collectively achieving objectives. So the Bush administration started a lot on this. This administration, the Obama administration, is really pushing those things forward. But we could do a lot better with the money we have today if we operated more efficiently. Now, it doesn't mean you don't need more money. And again, that's why we need to talk about what do we need this year to achieve objectives and goals? And then where does that position us to achieve the goals and objectives next year? Because there are upfront costs and things. Or you can save money this year, but next year, because you've saved that money and gotten more people in, then you need to open more clinics or start up more bed net distribution sites or open more maternal health clinics, then it's going to cost you a little bit more. And that we never had the ability in the U.S. government. We could barely track obligations or expenses. We now are developing a capacity to track these things so that we can have more efficiency and actually be more responsive. So, again, I mean, all of us are worried when we see money coming down, when we see these unobtained goals. But we don't need to jump to that. And especially if people like Ambassador Goosby are saying, we are okay this year. And he's not saying we're okay for the next 10 years. He's saying we're okay this year and have that constant calculation, that constant discussion, always working with Congress, always working with the advocacy community, and increasingly working with who else can pay for this. Who among the multilaterals, who among the in countries as their economies are growing. You know, one of the most exciting things, a lot of our investments are in Africa and global health. The World Bank just reported that the region of the world that is developing economically most rapidly is Africa. It's not Asia anymore. It's actually Africa. So as we work towards those things, how do we then have effectively a shared responsibility, which is what the administration talks about? So as Beth said, as long as we have that vision, and Larry said, as long as we have this vision, as long as it's explained, as long as we're doing the calculations, we can be anxious, but, you know, breathe a sigh of relief, and then position ourselves as we're in less constrained environments to implement that even more off of a stronger base of effectiveness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know what you all think. Yeah.
I don't know nearly as much as you do about the science of this, so I won't even try. I mean, I just think I think that, people are right to be concerned about whether we're going to be able to hit our targets or not. You know, I just heard Ambassador Guzmi speaking last week about the HIV/AIDS targets, and he was assuring folks that we were completely on target, and I've heard since that, you know, they think they could be, you know, able to even overshoot our targets, which would be fabulous. I think that for the rest of the GHI targets, many were developed at a time when we thought there was going to be $63 billion for GHI, and that certainly isn't the case. So I think that it's a good question. What do we honestly expect to be able to achieve? And, you know, is this the right mix of resources in order to achieve that? I would imagine that what went into figuring out this budget was some sense of prioritizing certain targets and then figuring out a way to actually achieve them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that accounts for the mix between bilateral and multilateral. That's something that accounts for why certain things are going down and certain things are not going down. But I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I just say that the one element the reaction of the advocacy community is something that should clearly have been anticipated. Mm-hmm. The greater the transparency to accompany just the numbers, I think, was something that should have been thought through mm-hmm. a little bit better. So I think that's what needs to be fully explained. I mean, some of the examples you gave are terrific. And if that can be translated into clear indication of achieving the goals and the commitments that we've already made, I think would do the administration a lot of good right now.
One of the things, I mean, that those are all somewhat optimistic. You get the vision and these examples. One of the things you sometimes hear or one hears is, what does it say about the pipeline? You know, is there a pipeline issue? Is that why we're all of a sudden able to kind of scale back on resources and do as much? I mean, do either of you want to, or any of you want to say anything about
the P word?
That P word. Yeah. I know I'm bringing the P word. I could also say other P word. I'm going to say presidential election. That's the other one I'm going to bring up.
I'm happy to jump in on that because I've looked at this over many, many years about our budgets across all development and health and all of our things. And every program has a pipeline. You have to have a pipeline in order to survive, to provide continuity. Mm-hmm. But there are good pipelines and there are bad pipelines. And again, this is where I think transparency would be to the advantage of the administration. The two countries that really jumped out at me, Kenya and Ethiopia.
Right.
Kenya dropping by 41% mm-hmm. and Ethiopia by about 80%. Well, I'm told that this is a pipeline issue, that there's sufficient funds to continue the current activities and programs in both countries without any break in services, treatment, or anything, utilizing money that was already in the pipeline. Well, that's fine, but I'd really like to know how you could, especially in Ethiopia's case, accumulate that much in a pipeline, and what is the overall PEPFAR pipeline. And it very well could be a good story. But with those precipitous cuts in this year, and it goes back to whether this is a one-time thing, and it raises questions about absorptive capacity in these countries, coupled with we are in a declining budget across the board. Mm-hmm. And Congress generally, when they see a pipeline that's the money is several years old and it's growing, they sometimes either divert the money to something that's more pressing, some emergency. I'll tell you that we're talking about the global health community. The humanitarian assistance mm-hmm. community is extremely upset with this budget request, and they will be looking to make shifts. And one of the first place Congress looks sometimes is a pipeline. So it needs to be explained, mm-hmm. and I think it needs to be kind of brought out in the light.
Do you have anything to add on that?
You're smiling. Well, first of all, I think the point of good and bad pipelines are mm-hmm. absolutely correct. And it's kind of thing that when people raise other phrases like treatment, entitlement, and mortgage, that mm-hmm. drives me up the wall mm-hmm. because, you know, that's actually a good thing because people are going to be alive for a long time. So there are good and bad pipelines, and you do need pipelines in order to maintain programs. That's what we have. But you also can't have these large, which is what I was mentioning earlier, the worst thing you can do in any budget environment is have a lot of money sitting around that you're not using effectively. You shouldn't be requesting it, and if you can't use it, or you should be shifting into other directions. Now is absolutely the worst time, and I think you know, Larry's point on being open about what these things are and how they happen. I mean, Ethiopia's met all of their goals despite having some money backed up. Mm-hmm. And that gets to how do you... And we could never follow this stuff before. I mean, mm-hmm. we literally could never follow this stuff before except for in bulk numbers. So now the capacity mm-hmm. has been... Which is an extraordinary thing in country and within our own U.S. system. It's an extraordinary thing about what happens in global health that no one else in the government has this kind of data. I mean, there are a couple of departments, defense, that actually have these type of data. We actually do. Mm-hmm. Pipeline, if you look at pipeline in our global health programs, at least I think PEPFAR has always run about 10%. I would compare that to anything in the U.S. government. And 10% is a, but it's large numbers, and so that winds up being a large number. And then you have to look at how long is that going to take to dry up and work with members of Congress on this is how long it will take us to utilize that, and then we'll go up. But if you just take that away, you're going to have to come right back and fill that in. So just shifting money today isn't going to get you any advantage whatsoever, which gets into the conversation of what can we use this year? That doesn't mean that next year we should be on the same downward trajectory, but what can we use this year? What can we use next year? And get that refined on what can we effectively use this year as long as everyone understands that that's not going to be a locked-in number. And that's the danger, and that's the tendency in mm-hmm. budgets, that once you come to a number, you're locked there or lower, not you're locked there this year because that's what you can use, but next year. Right. But that gets to the point of being able to explain, this is why we are where we are. Here are the efficiencies we're putting in place. This is how we're looking at how multilaterals and other countries contribute. We'll come back to you on an annual basis with those pieces of the puzzle so we can collectively have a budget. And I think that's, yes, there are politics in every, I mean, there's politics in every budget. That's the nature of the budget. It's the nature of the government. But I believe that that's probably how we got to these budgets, that they actually looked at all those factors and tried to come up with that with alternative pressures. But you can't, you also have to acknowledge the point that the advocacy community in Congress has to be an integral part of these discussions and a well-informed part of these discussions in order to succeed. And again, I go back to, that's, I think, how we did well in global health and particularly in PEPFAR and PMI, because we always have those honest conversations. This is what's working. This is what's not working. We need a little leeway to see if this will work or that will work. And I think this team has done a great job at trying to continue that and is really advanced the database that allows those conversations to be had. But, you know, it just, the budget just came out. It's going to take a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. You have to keep budgets secret. I mean, I'm sorry to the advocacy community, but you cannot function within a government if you're telling people what all your budgets are before you get out. It just doesn't work internally. It hurts you internally, and it hurts the process internally. But then you really need to be aggressive on talking about why you got to where you got to.
So we've gotten a few more questions, and almost all of them, I'll just say, are all about targets. You know, everyone's very concerned about the targets. They're very focused on the goals, the MDGs, the goals the U.S. government has set. One of the questions, one that just came through around that, was on maternal health and how could the proposed cut to maternal health allow us to work towards the MDGs and be a good global partner in that regard. That's one question that came in. The other was, I think, gets at this bilateral, multilateral piece and sort of the difficulty when that doesn't exist. So, for example, the NTD program got is proposed to have a 25% decrease. So we got two questions about that. One saying, what about that kind of program, which doesn't have the same multilateral instrument that's the sort of balancing there? What happens there? And so, again, these are hard things. There's no right answer at this moment, but those are the kinds of questions I think people are most worried about going forward.
And, I mean, they're valid questions because, you know, like I said before, when you see a number drop like that, it looks like it's being de-emphasized or it looks like it's being deprioritized. And I don't know that we've heard enough at this point to understand if that's the case mm-hmm. or to understand, you know, maybe there are efficiencies that we don't know about mm-hmm. And that have been found and can be exploited to get more bang for the buck with less buck. And it's possible. I mean, I think what we're seeing with the explanations for the bilateral HIV/AIDS cuts is that the administration has, you know, done, I have obviously not seen their homework, but they've done homework and they've decided mm-hmm. that they can achieve what they want to achieve within this smaller budget. But again, I think that's the issue with, you know, understanding that you can't leak the budget before the budget comes out, that's the issue with transparency. That's the issue with really turning this into a dialogue, because Because unless people understand the decision-making process and you know, the lessons learned and here's how we used to do things and here's how we feel like we went wrong and we found a better way and that's going to save us X amount mm-hmm. of dollars and we're still going to be able to hit our targets, there's a story that needs to be told. And that, I don't think that the story has been told yet. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. that's what's going to happen over the next couple of months.
Mm-hmm. And the maternal health one, you know, there is also like NTDs. There is no maternal right. health fund. Right. There are different agencies, but there's no maternal health right. fund.
Unlike child health.
Unlike child health, mm-hmm. where you have Gavi right. for the vaccinations, unlike AIDS, tuberculosis, mm-hmm. and malaria. So there is no global right. mechanism. And so I think that is a more difficult one. Now, the birth-spacing family planning budget was stable and goes mm-hmm. up, and that's certainly a part of saving mothers' lives, mm-hmm. an important part of saving mothers' lives. So, you know, there is some play there. On NTDs, I mean, I helped President Bush create the NTD initiative that he launched. So I have a particular affinity for that. But in all these things, I always try not to say, this is what I want, but, you know, how did people put budgets together rather than coming out, this is my interest, which is natural for all people to do. Others have expressed strong interest in NTDs, including the United Kingdom and the Gates Foundation and other significant players, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation. So I don't know if that went into part of the calculation, that there are other resources out there. And there has been some absorptive problem there. The maternal health one, I just don't know enough about. But it is one that I have to say I would want to spend a little more time on, because that is an area right. we can end preventable maternal health. There are only three to four major interventions. They're not expensive. They're not complicated. It's a handful of countries now that really have significant disproportionate numbers. So, but I do know it's a high priority for Raj. It's certainly a very high priority for Secretary Clinton. I mean, this is a woman who spent her life on this stuff. So, again, my tendency is to, until I know more, give a little more leeway to administrations than others. But these are valid questions and things that need to be asked.
I just say, and I'm the one sitting around this table that has the least to say about knowledge around maternal health. But I would say that with what strikes me is there's a 4 or 5% cut to maternal health line. But in fact, for maternal health, it's larger than that,
so
because Gavi is going up. And so I don't know what the it's around 8 or 9% mm-hmm. cut. Yeah. I mean, what are you choosing not to do? Or are the efficiencies there like in HIV AIDS, where you can still continue the same things? And again, having that out on the table, I think, would be helpful.
I mean, these discussions become so relevant also because Congress is going, I mean, you know, I think I've pressed very hard on, you know, the administration needing to be more transparent and to talk to Congress more. And I think that, you know, if I were arguing it from the other side, I could argue that Congress doesn't listen enough and do its homework enough and things like that. You know, you can probably argue it both ways. I'm sure Mark would argue it both ways, so I'm arguing it for him. But, you know, I think that that Congress has the pen, though. And so what's going to happen now is there's going to be a lot of temptation, especially with numbers going up and down. Percentage-wise, it's significant, but if, you know, with a couple of exceptions, a lot of times, you know, just sort of budget authority-wise, it's not that significant. Congress is going to be very tempted to rejigger the numbers based on how many members of Congress sign a letter saying, I care about this, or, you know, who calls this person and says, I care about this, and can you get me a few more million dollars? Well, if we're really in a situation here where a few million dollars, one way or the other, is the balance between achieving a target and not achieving a target, or if there is another donor somewhere who's stepping in and, you know, and backfilling stuff that we used to have mm-hmm. to provide, then that's the type of thing that Congress needs to know, because the administration almost has to argue against Congress sort of screwing with their numbers. Like if right. this is a delicate balance, then there has to be an effort really to maintain that delicate balance there, because Congress is very tempted and often does, you know, 5 million up here, right. 5 million down there. And there isn't necessarily a whole lot of sense of
right
what the consequences
either.
Are.
Right.
Right. And I, just to be clear, I actually wouldn't argue both sides of that.
Okay.
Congress to me is,
you,
if you don't treat Congress as a co-equal branch of for budgeting, you are dead. I mean, I from a global health and development perspective, I have always found, and I'm not kissing up to you, but the appropriation staff and the authorizing staff on the committees involved and a lot of the members are among the best out there. I mean, they really do try, like the administrations do, to do the best that they can. There aren't a lot of sub-agendas. They have to deal with a lot of groups just like the administration. But I have always found those committees trying to discern what is the best thing to do. And so the more information that's shared and the more that's discussed, I think the better chance you have. And the biggest fault you can have is by not treating Congress as a co-equal branch in the discovering a budget and not treating the advocacy community as a key third stool in that as part of a comprehensive approach. And if you do that, you can actually get a lot of latitude. You can get I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm a little uncomfortable about that, but we'll give you a little time to work it out. So I would always treat the administration, the Congress, and the advocacy community as all necessary components to come up with the best possible budget.
We'll actually all get to see what happens, too, because we'll be watching. I have a general question around the GHI, because we got a couple questions about the GHI, and Beth, you already brought it up as, it was a big announcement, $63 billion proposed. We're nowhere near that. And has it been clearly presented, et cetera? And one of the questions that was asked was, this budget, too, still talks about the QDDR transition plan of moving the GHI from state, leadership of the GHI from state to USAID. Are you hearing anything about that? The intention is to do it soon if the targets are met, the benchmarks are met. Any thoughts on that and what that might mean in the context of any of this? It doesn't have to just be Beth. It could be any of you.
I think that from my understanding, there's a process going on that's included a, USAID assessing itself against those benchmarks and outside consultancy assessing USAID or perceptions of USAID against those benchmarks as well, and that there's sort of an exhaustive process going on of interagency consultation around this. The QDDR deadline for making a decision is the end of the summer.
Right.
It could happen sooner, certainly. I mean, it's really up to the secretary's discretion. I think the larger question is less who gets to convene GHI and more what does it actually mean to be in charge of GHI? And what does GHI include? Does it include, all of our global health or just a small part of our global health? Certain aspects of the debate were taken off the table by the QDDR. But I think they're interesting things to think about. Mm-hmm. What does it actually mean to be in charge of the GHI? It's less about where it is in D.C., like where it's headquartered, where it physically is, and who actually gets to decide when the meetings are going to happen and who leads the meetings, and much more about how decisions are made, both here and also in the field.
Right. I don't think the budget request really provides any clarity to where the GHI leadership question is. It's more status quo on that. But I totally agree with Beth that this process that seems to be going on is too much about process. And I'm having a hard time kind of understanding what will change, what the role of USAID would actually be. Would it be in a position to actually lead on GHI or simply be a coordinator and a facilitator? Mm-hmm. And that's not a particularly good position to be in. I think that on a presidential initiative like this, we have Feed the Future, where USAID is in charge, and Raj Shah is accountable for success or lack of success on that initiative. I think we need the same thing on the Global Health Initiative, and right now it's a bit chaotic.
Mm-hmm. We're actually running near the end of our time, but I have a couple more just closing questions if anyone wants to take them. What will happen next? I mean, literally, what will happen next? Which I know, Larry, you could maybe lay out some of the we know that the Secretary of State will be testifying. Shah will be testifying. I mean, those processes will happen. Maybe you can lay those out. And if anyone has any concluding thoughts about the other P word, the presidential election, and does that change any of the calculus that we've been just talking about? I mean, it must, but how might it? Will it delay things, install them completely? Will it make them speed up in some ways that we might not have anticipated? I'll just leave it open to anyone who wants to comment on that.
Well, as far as the timeline going forward, I look first towards the House budget resolution, which will be getting going and possibly concluding next month. And this is, again, my kind of nonsense. But
we'll take it.
That the House Budget Committee will not spend to the maximum of what's allowed under the caps for non-defense programs. For defense programs, I think they'll add to what's in the budget request, right, which if they assume that, international affairs is under the security cap along with defense, I would expect to see several billions of dollars taken from international affairs and moved to the defense budget. We then go to the appropriation stage, and here is a question about will the Appropriations Committee follow the Budget Committee's lead on how to, on the caps, whether they go with what's allowable under law or they go with something lower. If you recall last year, the State Foreign Ops Subcommittee got a very low allocation. The other thing to consider there is with a low allocation, do they have an eye on whether they have to produce a bill that would pass the House floor, or is this an exercise for them just to mark up and hold that back until we get to the end game later in the year? And if it's if they think the bill is going to go to the House floor, then they've got to produce a bill that fits their caucus. And last year we saw a bill that was heavily skewed in favor of national security programs at the expense of development and global health. So those are the things. I don't expect much to action to occur in the Senate. And what I do think is when, once we get back to past the election, there will be a scramble and some serious consideration over a whole range of things. It's not just the caps. It's not just sequestration. It's not the final appropriations. But we've got debt ceiling cap to consider and tax cuts of whether there'll be tax increases will be reinstated. I suspect that what we'll see, if there is a deal at the end of the year, we're going to see a situation that looks totally different than we have right now that's governed by the Budget Control Act. The caps will be different. Sequestration may or may not be there. And, of course, there's always a likelihood that this will just be kicked into the next year.
Any other parting thoughts on that?
No. Very second best.
All right. Well, thank you. Our time's up, and I'd first like to thank the three of you, Mark Dybul, Larry Knowles, and Beth Tritter, for being here and sharing your perspectives and foreshadowing a little bit about what may happen. I'd also like to thank our audience for your questions. You'll find additional resources on today's In Focus on our website, globalhealth.kff.org, and we encourage you to share the video and transcript with your audiences. We also hope that you will join us for future webcasts of U.S. Global Health Policy In Focus. I'm Jen Cates of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.